Good morning, everyone. The meeting will come to order unofficially. Welcome to Education Innovation. And we're going to lead off this morning with an innovative idea. Representative Fenton, would you like to come to the testifying table and prepare to introduce your bill? We're close to quorum, I think. One more. The meeting is officially called to order. Representative Whalen, will you please move the minutes from last night and yesterday?
Yes,
Representative Whalen moves the minutes of March 12th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Welcome, Representative Fenton. Today, members, we're going to hear first House File 1529. It is innovative. It is an educational saving accounts for our students with special needs. And we're going to be very interested in hearing the testimony that's to come. This is, I don't think, a bill that's ever been heard in our state, so this is great. Representative Fenton, I will move House File 1529 to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. So please say your name for the record and begin to explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I'm Representative Kelly Fenton, and House File 29, I'm sorry, Education Savings Accounts for Students with Special Needs. Parents know best the needs of their children, and this bill is putting parents in the driver's seat of their child's education. This legislation empowers families, giving them more educational options to meet those needs. It is time that we start thinking differently and offer big, new, innovative ideas in the long tradition of Minnesota empowering parents dating back to Orville Freeman. So what is this? This is a pilot program of 5 years, an experiment to give kids with special needs the best possible education. Who would qualify? Students with an active individualized education program, or IEP, within the public school are eligible to apply for an education savings account. What could the money be spent on? Each account could be spent on approved educational expenses like private school tuition, educational therapy, tutoring, other things such as occupational therapies, physical therapies, transportation. How does this process begin? Parents will sign a compliance agreement for proper use of funds, and the Commissioner of Education is empowered to do random audits. And there are anti-fraud mechanisms as well, such as merchant category codes, the ability to freeze accounts, there's a fraud hotline, and then three strikes, you're out policy as well. Where could the dollars be spent? Participating private schools must be accredited and approved by the Commissioner of Education. Tutors and therapists must be licensed or certified. Funding. Currently, this legislation is drafted under existing framework of Minnesota law, so it's per pupil funding plus the state's contribution to special ed. So this bill reflects current law. However, we're very willing to work with legislators to get the funding formula right before it ends up likely in Ed Finance as well, or the next committee. How is this administered? The Commissioner of Education, I look forward to working with the Commissioner of Education to put the right structure and safeguards and have it reflect the state's funding for children with special needs. So, and built in here is a funding for administrative costs as well. For the Commissioner can deduct up to 6% for administrative costs. That's built into this legislation as well. So So I think with that, I'm going to turn it over to my first testifier, Lee McGrath, and then we've got a lot of others as well.
And Representative Fenton and members, I have to amend the motion. This 1529 will be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. We've just received that message. So instead of going to civil law first, it will go to government operations. Okay. So please know that that I've amended that motion. Welcome to our committee, Mr. McGrath. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chairman, members, my name is Lee McGrath. I'm the managing attorney for the Institute for Justice, a public interest law firm headquartered in Arlington, Virginia. I run the Minnesota office of the Institute. I'm also a board member at Oak. We are very enthusiastic at the Institute for Justice about this piece of legislation. It is a pilot program. It is innovative. It is exciting. It is about parents having the opportunity to customize education for their children with special needs. I'm particularly proud of the work that my colleague in Arizona did in developing this program. It is popular in Arizona. Approximately 1,700 families are using it. It is also very popular in Florida, where about 30,000 parents are using this program. One of the things that my law firm does is that we defend these programs when they are challenged in court. And I can pledge to the chair and to the committee that, one, this bill is constitutional under the United States Constitution as well as the Minnesota Constitution, and secondly, that my law firm will commit resources should this bill be enacted and challenged. We will intervene and defend the constitutionality of this law at no expense to the taxpayers of Minnesota. With that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions about the bill, as well as any related questions.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. I think there are some in the audience who would like to testify to this that you have invited here today. So please stay around, Mr. McGrath, and we'll call forward. I see Mr. Pearlstein is here, and come forward, all four of you, and pages, make sure there's seating available for them so we can hear their testimony in an efficient way. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
I am Mitch Pearlstein, and I'm president of Center of the American Experiment, and also today representing the Opportunity for All Kids, New Coalition, Oak, of which I am pleased to be the president. And Madam Chair, Representative Fenton, great pleasure, members of the committee, to be here. Let me make three very quick points about Oak. This is a coalition made up of organizations and individuals who have been involved in educational reform efforts for a long time. It is the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, Minnesota Districts North and South, Minnesota Business Partnership, Minnesota Catholic Conference, Minnesota Independent School Forum, Better Ed, and American Experiment, of course, and Mr. McGrath. Number two, Minnesota has a terrific history in expanding educational options for families. If you go back, well, first of all, the educational deductions, that law goes back to the mid-1950s. But starting in the mid-1980s, there was this great surge. We had post-secondary enrollment options passed in the mid-1980s, Governor Perpich leading the way and Representative Connie Leibon. And under Governor Perpich, we had inter-district choice and intra-district choice. And then we had charter schools in 1991, my good friend Senator Ember Reichgott-Young and others leading the way. And then in 1997, under Governor Carlson, we had the expansion of tax credits, or the institution, I should say, of tax credits for certain educational expenses. We used to lead the nation on matters of expanding freedom and education. We were the locomotive. We have fallen back. Some people like the metaphor, others perhaps not. We are now approaching the caboose. We need to get to the front of the train again, and this legislation does that. And the final, more personal point, my wife and I, 18 years ago, when she was five, my daughter, not my wife, we adopted a special needs child through Hennepin County. And if we did not have various options to help my daughter, various programs, residential and other programs, I don't know what in the world we would have done. We were fortunate in that the adoption was through Hennepin County, so the county and our insurance picked up expenses. But the larger point is we had options. And what I'm interested in, what my colleagues are interested in, is expanding options for parents to better serve their children. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Perlstein. And will you proceed, please? Introduce yourself for the record and say begin.
My name is Wyan Rasmussen, and I am the head of school at Academy of Whole Learning. We're a school located in St. Louis Park, and our mission is to provide personalized learning paths for qualified students on the autism spectrum or with intellectual disabilities. So every one of our students at our school is on the autism spectrum or has an intellectual disability. Even though we're located in St. Louis Park, our families come from all over the metro area and even some outside of the metro area. You'll hear from one of our parents who literally spends 4 hours a day in her car to get to our school. I know that parents are looking for more options because the number of inquiries at our school has more than quadrupled in the last 2 years. So just in January and February of this year, we've had the same number of inquiries, calls in asking about our programs, as we have had all of last year. So it is, I know it's a need out there. Last night we had an open house at our school. It was very fun. All of our teachers were there. We had parents coming from as far as Elk River and St. Cloud. We had a family coming from Wisconsin. We had a family fly in from New York. So there are not that many schools that offer the specialized services that we do, but we enjoy it. We love it. I'm going to tell you a story about two of our kids just quickly. Students with autism spectrum disorder have a hard time making that transition, making the change, coming into anything new in their whole day. And so we had a student that came in, this is his second year now, but he came in last year and he could not get past the front entryway. He stayed there for the whole day. He literally stayed in the front entryway for the entire day. We stayed with him and got to know him. The next day he came in and he took step by step. It took him an hour and a half. I walked with him for an hour and a half, and it was not very far. It's from here to that back wall to get to his classroom. Now that he's coming every day, he just comes into the classroom. He enjoys it. He's actually participating on our basketball team. We have 35 students at our school. 24 of them are on our Special Olympics, three of our Special Olympics basketball teams. We offer as many pieces as we can for the students to help them increase their social skills. Most of our students gain 1 to 2 years worth of academic gains in that first year they're at our school. As we're filling, we're finding out what standards are missing, what grade level standards are missing, and targeting those. So that is very exciting to see. I was going to tell you about another student we have who, in her previous school, she could not go to the school because of the sensory pieces of the school. It's very bright. There's a lot of kids, naturally, like 30 kids in her classroom. It was loud. She could not do that. So she was having major panic attacks every day, underneath her desk, screaming and crying. And this is a student that you would not, if you saw her in our school now, you would have no idea. And I didn't know until this week that in her previous school, she had conditional procedures on her IEP where she was held by three people when she would have these outbursts because they didn't know what to do with her. I've never seen an outburst at all at our school, but you walk into our classrooms and this is how we speak in the classrooms. This is how the teachers speak. It's this quiet. And if a student gets louder, we just get quieter. and it's a very quiet place. The lights, we don't turn the lights on at all. We have floor lamps in occasional corners. We have the drapes are open and the sunlight is coming in. And if you walk past, it's such an inviting place, and the kids are all so fully engaged in their learning. But every student that has come to our school, every single one, that parent made that initial phone call because it wasn't successful in their previous school. Our board of directors, we're a nonprofit, so we have a nonprofit board. Our board of directors has had so many conversations about how we can make our school more affordable to more parents so that we can have a wider socioeconomic base of families coming to our school. This actually hurts when, in order to keep the school sustainable, we have to charge a tuition, or a significant tuition, I guess. This bill would allow so many parents the opportunity to come to our school, and we would be able to serve so many more. We are limited every year by how much we can grow our school. Our school could be hundreds of kids, but we have to be so very careful because we can only grow our school as fast as our development dollars, our fundraiser dollars come in to allow for more expenses for the following year. So we are growing it very, very slowly. This would allow more families to come, and we'd be able to reach more families. And then finally, I want to tell you that we have two families that have been making the sacrifice to come to our school over the last 2 years, and they just can no longer do it. So it just breaks my heart to know that two of our families will not be back next year. It's just simply the sacrifices. They can no longer do it. So thank you very much for the opportunity to share this story. I would like to introduce two parents from our school that would like to speak. First is Melissa Sirik.
Welcome to our committee, Ms. Sirik. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Hi, my name is Melissa Schreck. I'm a single mom of four kids, and I'm here to tell you about my family. Three of my four kids have autism and special needs. I have twin boys that are 14, and both of them are autistic, and then I have a younger daughter who's 9, and she also has autism. They have a wide range of medical and health issues, developmental delays, and learning disabilities. The last I counted, my kids had 27 medical and therapy providers between all three of them. Over the years, as first one of my kids, then two, then three were diagnosed with special needs, it became clear that I was going to need extra help for all of them to be successful in school. So first, I put them in a very small Christian school that had some on-site special ed support, and it wasn't long before I knew that they would need more help than the school had to offer. Few of the teachers were trained to deal with autism, and many had limited knowledge at best about autism at all. The teachers were willing to do whatever I wanted them to do to help my kids, but they looked to me to direct what was needed, and it was overwhelming because I'm not an expert, I'm just a mom. I didn't know how to best teach my kids that are complex learners. So next I pursued special ed IEPs for them through our public school district. And our public school in our neighborhood shockingly had little to offer us. While the classroom teachers would tell me that my kids could not keep up or function in a regular mainstream room, the district said that they hadn't failed enough academically to qualify for help. One of my kids who has the most needs was offered a mere 45 minutes of academic help a week, which is clearly not enough. The public school later advised my twins, who were approaching high school, that they shouldn't focus so much on academics, but concentrate on life skills. Yet the public school in our district, I was told, offered minimal life skill classes, only one class for one semester in all 4 years of their high school. So desperate, and this shows I was really desperate, I pulled them out of school and tried to homeschool them. It was a temporary measure that was not ideal for me as a single mom that needed to work, but I did my best to teach them and find work that I could do from home. And all the while, I researched other school options. It was then that I learned about the Academy of Whole Learning. It seemed like the perfect fit. It was a private school for kids with autism, and the teachers were experts in autism, and they taught life skills and social skills every day to the kids, as well as having other on-site services like speech and occupational therapy. It was clearly a good option to try, and so I immediately enrolled two of my kids in the school last fall. This is all great and seems like a happy ending, but these special ed expertise comes with a very steep price, and I'm a single mom who has received no child support for the last 3.5 years, not one penny. Not only do I now have 4 kids in 3 different schools all over the metro, but I'm driving up to 100 miles a day round trip to get them all to their schools and back. I also have a hefty tuition bill that feels like I'm paying college tuition without the option of a loan. I'm currently working 4 jobs just to cover tuition and to keep food on the table. One of the jobs I'm working actually is as a substitute teacher at the Academy of Home Learning. I've had garage sales, pawn jewelry, and borrowed against my 401k, just to name a few things to help scrape up tuition. All of this has been exhausting, and I'm really tired. A bill like the one proposed would be life-changing for my kids and I. It would be amazing to have some of the financial burden eased, and I worry all the time about money and paying for all of this. I've exhausted every option for my kids, from private school to public school to homeschool, and I'll do whatever I can at this point to keep them at the Academy of Whole Learning. When I see the progress they're making in just the few months since they started, it reinforces to me that this is exactly where they need to be. And I know in my heart that someday I can look back and feel good that I've done everything I could for my kids to give them a chance at a good future. So please consider supporting this bill to help so many families like mine in Minnesota that are struggling financially to give our kids a good future.
Thank you, Ms. Schreck. And others, Representative Fenton? Another parent.
I'm a testifier, yep.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Amy Christensen-Bruce. I live in the Stillwater area, and I have 2 children, both with special needs. My 6th graders' learning challenges include autism, ADHD, and dysgraphia, and my 4th graders' challenges include autism, ADHD, and cognitive delay. My 6th grader is higher functioning and has been doing well at his private school in Maplewood since pre-K, but this is mostly because, even though not required to, his private school has provided him with an IEP-like plan, including supports, modifications, and accommodations. We hope our child can continue to go to this school, but as he has gotten older, he's had a harder time, and we've been forced to look at other schools for him that can better manage his learning challenges. My 4th grader's educational experience hasn't been as smooth. He is lower functioning than his brother, and he's on his 4th school. His educational experience includes 2 different public school districts and 1 charter school. Our experience with these schools includes PACER advocates, attorneys, thousands of dollars in attorney's fees, conciliation conferences, and mediations. In addition, it includes with the action with the Minnesota Department of Education and eventually the U.S. Department of Education Office of Civil Rights. Trying to secure an appropriate education for my younger son at his former public schools was time-consuming, painful, and surprisingly expensive. And not just for us. It was expensive for the schools, the various state agencies, the court system, and PACER, which is a nonprofit advocacy agency. The bottom line is that 2 different public schools and 1 charter school, or 2 different public school models, failed my child. They failed to educate him. And I know that he is capable of learning, and I know when he is not being educated. Like many parents in our situation, my husband and I sought out something different that would work for him, and now he attends the Whole Learning School in St. Louis Park. First, let me say how nice it is to drop him off at school, at a school that actually wants him and that I'm not fighting with. He receives consistent and coordinated instruction because his teachers come to work and they talk with each other and his therapist daily. My son is progressing academically without a para doing the work for him. In addition, the Academy of Whole Learning honestly reports his progress. Sadly, even with all the progress he has already made at the Academy of Whole Learning, he is still 2 grade levels below where he should be. At the Academy of Whole Learning, my questions are answered promptly and with transparency. They consider themselves accountable to the parents, which is unlike the 3 public schools we have experienced. My son is able to receive his speech and occupational therapy at this school, and his therapists talk with his teachers for maximum effect. In addition, my son is finally making friends, and he's able to participate in all kinds of after-school activities that he wasn't able to before, like karate, piano, chess, art, Lego club, and basketball. Every day, we drive our 4th grader from near the Wisconsin-Minnesota border to St. Louis Park for school, dropping off our older child in Maplewood first. On a good day, with dry pavement and no accidents, I spend 4 hours in the car getting both my children to their schools. The transportation costs alone associated with getting our children educated are unbelievable, and they don't compare to our tuition costs. Passing this bill will help alleviate some of the financial pressures we face to get our kids educated. This week, I read the following statistic on the Autism Society's website. It costs more than $8,600 extra per year to educate a child with autism. The average cost of educating a child is about $12,000. In my opinion, passing this bill would be a win-win for both parents and the school districts. We parents can choose the schools that are best able to meet our children's needs, and nobody knows their needs better than we do. In addition, the districts may experience greater efficiency as well, because they will have to write and comply with less individual plans. Finally, in all fairness, no school district should receive funds for a special needs child they cannot or will not and do not actually educate. I want to close by saying this. Please do not take my comments to paint me as being anti-public schools. I am a proud product of the Minneapolis and St. Louis Park public school districts. I had every intention of sending my children to public schools, but autism changed everything. I have no religious affiliations, not even membership, but would send my children, if needed, to any religiously affiliated school if that is what it would take to get them an education. Finally, in general, it's hard to find someone more left than me on any political issue. So if I can support this bill, anyone can. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen-Bruce. Thank you, Ms. Rasmussen, for explaining to us the great work that you're doing at the Academy of Whole Learning. Are there other testifiers, Representative Fenton? Then I think we'll hear from those with concerns and parents. And Ms. Rasmussen, please stay so that you can address questions from the committee. Are there those with concerns who would like to come forward? Mr. Uni, from the department. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee. My name is Adosh Uni with the Minnesota Department of Education. I've had the opportunity to reach out briefly to the author. As we know, and as the author seen, the bill has a lot of moving parts. And the department experts now are just kind of looking at the parts and seeing how we can get them, how we can look at how they work together and where the department capacities are. Obviously, like the author, we're committed to making sure all children have great and consistent education, and we look forward to working with the author in the future to make sure it works.
Thank you, Mr. Oni. Are there others in the audience who would like to express concerns? School Boards Association, please come down. And if there's anyone else, please come forward. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. I feel a little bit like the Price is Right. Come on down. I wish I had better testimony for Representative Fenton. We, like the department, have concerns about this bill in many ways. We're worried about suffering the same fate as the dyslexia bill did. Now, if you remember with that bill, they had to be evaluated by the school district, and then they would stop service to receive the service. And we're worried that this bill would create a huge influx of people requesting a special education evaluation. And then we'd say the child needs services, and the parents would say, I don't want services, because that sort of is when that special ed account can go forward. And we feel that would be a really undue burden on the school districts. It's not clear to us how the language runs through between, for instance, if you look at line 3.1, funds may be used for services provided by a public school, which means a student would have to be enrolled at least part-time in a public school. Also, special education students who receive services at a public school would most likely get them for free, assuming they have a FAPE. So it's not, the details really need to be firmed up. Is 4.5 through 4.9, so that these special ed accounts would receive our general education formula and then all the special ed dollars around that child to go into it. This section here talks about specifically the special education funding, which is a mixture of state aid and federal funds. And our question would be, when we receive that money, we also take on the responsibility of being checked through the Office of Compliance at MDE to make sure our IEPs are in tune with those programs. And so our question is, sort of when you accept that money, it comes with a little bit of responsibility, and that is the compliance with federal law, at least going forward, pretty clear. They would not cover our, would not fall under our a lot of our laws going forward. So there's a lot of moving parts in this, Madam Chairman, and we would like to delve through it a little bit more, but it certainly brings some substantial concern going forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to express concerns? Welcome, Ms. Gilbert.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools, and I have to say that I haven't had a chance to speak with the author. When I first looked at the bill, I actually thought it was a pre-tax opportunity for parents to put money aside for tuition, so I was confused initially about the bill. But I think that this is a good opportunity to talk about the way the state funds special education. Right now, based on the Department of Education's report for 2013, districts were spending $585 million out of their general fund to provide services for special education. In addition to that, school districts provide tuition for 90% of the additional cost for charter schools for special education. In the case of like the deaf school, we pay 100% of the difference in what they spend. And so I think that this is a very good discussion. I think the parents raised issues about why a lot of districts are struggling with their special education programs, because they are forced every single day to look and see whether they're going to spend money on how much money from their regular instruction programs they can afford to spend on special education. And so I think that, this is a good example of what's going on every day with districts trying to make that decision. And that special education cross-subsidy is supposed to grow to $619 million. As I was listening to the conversation, I was surprised that the school didn't become a charter school, actually, because it would have availed itself of all of the gen ed, special ed, capital operating revenue, and the school could actually bill the resident districts for the difference, because they would likely be over 70% students with IEPs, and they would act and be much like the Metro Deaf School, which spends over $16,000 per pupil, and I have no idea what your tuition is, but I do think Minnesota is unique that way and does have options for schools that do serve a niche. So I would just like to say I think that we generally share concern about a voucher-type program. We feel that providing special education services should be, we should all be operating by the same rules as far as licensing and regulation and auditing, which is what we are under. And so I think this does beg a bigger discussion about how we do provide and pay for special education services in the state.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Before we move to questions, is there anyone else from the public who would like to express interest in this bill? Hearing none, we'll start with Representative Erdahl has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could I have, he's right on cue. That's because I told him I was going to ask a question of him. Mr. McGrath, I'd like to ask a question. First of all, I certainly share some of these concerns. It's a travesty, I think, that our federal government particularly has not lived up to their commitment regarding special education. And I understand that, the needs, that grow from that. And but I have a question raised to me, and I don't mean this to construe my position on the legislation, but this has been asked, and I thought I would just get some clarification here today. Article 13, Section 2 of the Minnesota State Constitution reads, prohibition as to aiding sectarian school. In no case shall any public money or property be appropriated or used for the support of schools wherein the distinctive doctrines, creeds, or tenets of any particular Christian or other religious sect are promulgated or taught. Mr. Graff, I'd like you to clarify how you think this ties into this particular piece of legislation. And then a specific question I have is, would this mean that money to private non-sectarian schools would be permitted but not to sectarian?
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chairman, Representative Erdahl, this bill is constitutional. The Blaine Amendment, which is in Article 13, was adopted in the Minnesota Constitution in 1877. It comes with a rich, rich history of xenophobia against recent immigrants. It was designed to protect the status quo of the day. Fortunately, the United States Supreme Court has made it clear about how programs like this that empower parents and give parents a menu of choices survives challenges brought under the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. They don't violate the separation of church and state. And Minnesota courts also look at the menu of choices and say that is sufficient so as to not to violate this despicable component of our state constitution. Specifically, if you'd like it, Mr. Representative, it was the Minnesota Federation of Teachers versus Mamenga in 1993 that laid out a four-part test. And this bill will be upheld because it meets all four components of that test. If the committee would like, I'd be happy to walk through the components of that test, but we're getting deep in the weeds.
Representative Erdahl, further question?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So basically you're suggesting that, Ms. McGrath, that we have a provision in our Constitution that is uncalled for, undated, or maybe not constitutional?
No.
Mr. McGrath.
I'm just...
Chairman, Representative Erdahl, it is part of Minnesota's Constitution. It is, in my opinion, it's an unfortunate part of Minnesota's Constitution. However, regardless of my opinion about its history, the much more important thing is how Minnesota courts have interpreted it. And it has allowed that interpretation has allowed all sorts of programs that this legislature has enacted in terms of support for busing, in terms of support for books, in all sorts of support, provided that it is the parent who has a menu of choices and can choose secular, sectarian, independent therapy, education and therapies. It will be upheld because the court has recognized that when the parent is making the decision as to how to spend and select options from a menu of choices that the legislature has provided, then it will be constitutional.
Okay,
Representative
Chair,
Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath, for that clarification. I'm glad you brought up busing because that was one question that I'd meant to ask as well as an example of how this is done today. Thank you.
Representative Yabuso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have questions. I've got comments. I appreciate the spirit of the bill, but I really think it's much too broad. Particularly because an eligible student is any student who's had an IEP. That's a rather large category of students. And as such, this is really a virtual voucher bill. Any student who has an IEP gets a voucher to go to private school. I appreciate that some of those settings provide advantages and some of them provide huge advantages from what we've been hearing. Some of them have smaller classes and whatever, but it's a voucher to go to private school. There's a sort of opposite concern that was stated by somebody that there's an advantage for the district because they could have fewer IEPs, and that would concern me. And if there's a school, it wouldn't be my district. I don't know if it would ever happen in Minnesota, but that would provide an incentive to gently nudge people out the door that you didn't want to deal with. On page 2, lines 2.16, 2.1, well, it's 2.15 to 2.19, the parent acknowledges that the student has no entitlement to the free and appropriate public education. Sometimes we run into legal difficulties when we try to sign away minors' legal rights. So that's something that should get discussed with somebody. We do have a lawyer up there at the table, so maybe he can answer. That might be a question I actually had. On lines in paragraph B, right below that, there's the list of things you could spend the money for. And this is similar to the list of things you can spend the money for the tax credit or tax deduction that parents can get. But those are a much, much smaller amount of allowed public money, and actually it's money the parent spends and then just reaps a tax benefit off. This is actually using our public education dollars that have been allotted and giving them to the parents' discretion to spend for these things. I kind of note on line 2.25, payment to a tutor, that would include me. There's no vetting of whether any or all of these, you know, choices would meet the standards that we set for public education. Nobody's going to check my credentials. Now, you know, it's the parent's choice doing that, but the parent has the choice to do that now with their own money. But we're giving the parent the choice to do that with public money, and that's quite a different thing.
Well, Representative Urusso, the public is all of us.
Yes, ma'am. But that's why we're here. We've been spending years and years and years trying to make sure that we have the standards and accountability in place for public education, and this undermines some of that. And then the final page, the issue we were just discussing about the constitutionality, I'm not questioning the constitutionality, but I am concerned that, you know, when we as it was just mentioned, we do have the whole charter school system, and one of the key facets of charter school law is that a charter school has to accept students without regard to race, religion, country of origin, marital status of the parents, physical disability, and so on. And there's no requirement for these schools, and it's specifically stated there's not going to be any requirement because admissions policies are in this list of things we're not going to tinker with. So this really doesn't meet the conditions for the other spending of our public education money. So I'm not happy with how broad it is. I really wish we would fix our issues with special education. I'm totally in sympathy with that, but I think this goes too far. Thanks.
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chairman, Representative Urusso, thank you for the opportunity to address some of the issues that are often raised. There is nothing wrong with vouchers and scholarships, but this bill isn't a voucher or scholarship. You have embraced, we here in the state of Minnesota have embraced vouchers and scholarships for pre-K. That is part of the governor's plan. We're in that business. The federal government has embraced vouchers and scholarships in the GI Bill and Pell Grants and funding. We're in that business as well. One reason why, even if there's nothing wrong with those things, this is not a voucher, is because a voucher can only be spent in one place. The beauty, the innovation here is that the parent is given a menu of choices, from occupational therapies to physical therapies, and to private education, to buying programs in public schools. It is filled with the heart of what every parent wants, is the ability to customize the education to meet her child's needs. In terms of IEPs and why they're so essential, we think that this is an important control. I would ask those who might oppose the requirement for an IEP to ask, well, what other control do you want in terms of qualifying and quantifying the needs of the special education control? This is an important anti-fraud component of the bill, respecting the public funds that are going to go to support the child. In terms of vetting and licensing, the bill is clear that services must be provided by providers who have been recognized, licensed, and approved by the state and by the Commissioner of Education.
Representative Yarusso, you have, I think, a follow-up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I disagree with the idea that a voucher could only be spent in one place. There are certainly many, many kinds of vouchers, depending on how you craft them. We don't need to get into a tit-for-tat on that. But one of my concerns with the broadness of anyone with an IEP qualifying is that, to put it bluntly, this would allow schools to recruit kids coming with their education dollars. There's nothing in this bill that would prevent this. There's nothing in this bill that would prevent a certain East Side school that I have a long history with of recruiting hockey players that would come with their public dollars. And so on. There's nothing in this bill that would prevent that.
So, Mr. McGrath, is this the language that mirrors Arizona's law or Florida's law?
This, Madam Chairman, this language has evolved from Arizona and Florida and other states. It addresses the core issue of focusing in on students with disabilities and who need special needs, it is not a tool to recruit hockey players. It strikes the right balance between empowering parents and protecting the taxpayers' interest in that the funds will be used properly. And to one point that Representative Yarusso raised that I did not address was the idea of in section 2.13 the parent acknowledging and taking responsibility as the guardian and legal advocate for a minor child. It has to be clear that the parent can't double dip. The parent can't get an ESA account and still attempt to enroll in the public schools. So it's a program. It is a piece of legislation that has been subject to other state legislators' review.
Ms. Christensen-Bruce, you would like to say something, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that, you know, in writing, our children are entitled to go to public and charter schools. But when we get there, it doesn't feel like that. You know, we're there, and our daily lives are very difficult. And you feel, I mean, there's so much relief now that I'm walking into a school and not facing that every day. They don't want us there. And quite frankly, we don't want to be there. And I have a higher-functioning child. So my higher-functioning, I always refer to him as low-functioning normal, high-functioning special ed. There are a lot more kids that need attention than him, more attention than him. So he gets lost in the shuffle. And so that's why I appreciate having the Academy of Whole Learning for my child to go to, because it just wasn't getting done at the public schools.
Thank you.
Mr.
McGrath.
Madam Chairman, the report that you asked about other states, the report that my colleague from Arizona tells me is that the public schools in Arizona are trying their hardest. there is goodwill and good effort. It is not a the success of the education savings account in Arizona is not a product of is not a criticism of the capabilities and commitments of the public school teachers in Arizona. It is just a question of can specialists take those receive those funds at the command of a mother and design a customized education to meet that child's needs.
Representative Fenton.
Madam Chair, can I just say, too, as a mother of three children, one who is dyslexic, I can tell you that there is nobody that is going to be more accountable to that child's education than the parents themselves. And what this is about is an education. Education should be about serving the individual needs of every single child. And parents know best, and they just want the best education possible for their children. And that is what this is about.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rasmussen, good morning. Did I get that right, Rasmussen?
Yes.
Wonderful. Question, your school uses the Common Core standards.
Yes.
Do you do Common Core in both English language arts and math? The state has only applied them in English language arts and not in math. How do you handle it at your school?
Ms. Rasmussen.
We use Common Core state standards for English language arts. We also, Minnesota has an additional in English language arts identified writing standards in addition to the Common Core, so we use Minnesota's old English language standards in addition, and we are using Common Core state standards for math as well. I like the Minnesota's math standards. I really like the way they were organized, but because Minnesota is one of the only states in the union that is using their different math standards, we are able to have many more resources if we use the Common Core state math standards. It's much more affordable. Prices come down and instructional materials.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Rasmussen, we're at the beginning of the MCA testing season. Can you just talk about the preparations in your school for the MCAs?
Ms. Rasmussen.
Thank you. As a private school, we do not use the MCAs. We use the NWEA, which is a national standardized test score. I like the NWEA's much better because they are self-leveling. So if a student is doing well, then the questions become harder. If the student is not able to answer those questions, the questions become easier so that it eventually is able to identify the exact area that the student needs, is able to accomplish and what their target areas are. The MCAs are given to students at grade level. So if you have a third grade student, they are given a third grade test. If you're a fifth grade student, they're given a fifth grade test. And most of our students come to us significantly below grade level, and so they would just simply fail a test like that. And it's more important for us to know where their gaps are, where their holes are, so that we can directly address those and help them gain grade level standards.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question to the author. In reviewing the bill, I didn't see a requirement for all private schools to accept special education students. Was that an omission? Did I misread the bill? Was it an oversight on my part? Can you speak to students having access to the private school that the parent wishes the child to attend under your program?
So, again, this is where I want to work with other legislators and the Department of Ed, because the commissioner will approve. The commissioner, as the bill is written, will approve which the school has to be an accredited school, first of all. But the commissioner has the authority to approve which schools would fit under the program where they would allow the dollars to go.
Representative Dabney, there's rulemaking, which is why it's going to government operations.
Okay, but Madam Chair, I'm not sure that the author understood the question. I'm not talking about a requirement on the commissioner. I'm talking about a requirement on private schools that they accept special education students so that parents can choose the school that they wish. Under federal law, these parents' children have a right to a public education, and public schools cannot turn them away. you may choose to go elsewhere, but the public schools cannot turn them away. Under your bill, would a private school be able to turn away a special education student?
Representative Fenton.
I'm going to refer to
Mr. McGrath.
The attorney, Lee McGrath.
Madam Chairman, Representative Dabney, the power of this bill is the power of the parent to come with resources to the school and to help the school meet those requirements. It is a voluntary program for the school. It is a voluntary program for the parents. It is the meeting of the minds when parent and school come together to meet these requirements. And so it is a option to parents. But let me say, there are hundreds of there are many private and religious schools that are anxious to take these children. This is just one of them. And so the desire to extend the mission of these schools is present in many schools.
Representative Dabney.
So, Mr. McGrath, that was a long-winded no.
It was an answer, Representative Dabney, to the power of the power and beauty of this piece of legislation.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. McGrath, it was a long-winded no. There's no requirement that under this bill that special education students get equal access to private education as they have to public education. These parents, in fact, would not have the opportunity to send their child to the school of their choice because there's no requirement that the schools accept them. I always remember back to Academy of the Holy Angels a few years ago. Excellent Catholic school. I believe it's in South Minneapolis. It might be in Richfield. I'm not sure the exact location. High school, they had two students who applied, twins. both of them had been raised through private Catholic schools from kindergarten. One of them was on the football team for the middle school that they went. The other one was the manager of the football team. Academy of the Holy Angels accepted both of them. In the summer, the parents showed up, and the school figured out that one of the kids, the manager of the football team, was in a wheelchair. And Academy of the Holy Angels sent them a letter and said, "We'll take the football player, but we won't accept your other child. We don't provide services to kids like yours. Yeah, you should send them to the public schools." So we're setting up a separate program that doesn't accept all children, that doesn't comply with state standards and state transparency and accountability systems. Rather than dealing, as was mentioned by one of the Ms. Gilbert, one of the testifiers, instead of dealing with the issue of special education funding on both the federal and the state level. I won't get into the constitutionality question, but Florida found similar programs, Florida Supreme Court, to be unconstitutional because of the language in their state constitution about a uniform system of public schools. And in fact, Minnesota's state constitution has very similar language on the uniform system of public education. And Ms. Rasmussen, you're allowed to run whatever school you want. I have no objection to that. If this meets the needs of these the children you serve, wonderful. But it's not part of a uniform system of public education, which is what is the constitutional obligation for Minnesota. And what the Florida Supreme Court said was, unless the Constitution says, whatever, then it has to be a uniform system of public education. This is not that. And instead sets up a parallel system that doesn't meet the accountability standards, doesn't meet the transparency standards that our state constitution requires, and instead abandons special ed children to whatever provider is chosen and does not hold that provider then publicly accountable for the use of the funds.
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chairman, Representative Dabney, I welcome the debate about the constitutionality of this. If you're going to, if one ties his fate to the Florida Supreme Court, I think one is in deep deep trouble.
On that, we agree.
Having acknowledged that, Representative Dabney, I thank you, and I put my faith in the Minnesota court system that time and time again has approved the actions that this state legislature has done to help parents create a system that complements the uniform system that you speak of, and I'm happy to go into the fine details of that with any member. So thank you.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Fenton. I appreciate the spirit that you brought this bill forward in, and the stories from the parents. Thank you for coming. You obviously have very busy lives to share your stories, and that was very effective too. And and you had mentioned, and I'm sorry, I'm Amy, you had mentioned that you didn't feel welcome, that they didn't want you there. Mm-hmm. And I would just like to comment, I'm so sorry that you had that feeling, but that many parents and there are surveys that have been done in various school districts that I know of that shows that many parents of kids with IEPs love their schools, feel their kids are being well taken care of, and that they're reaching their potential. So I think that's kind of an important thing to get out there on the table. And then I just had a few questions, and I was just wondering, and Ms. Rasmussen, it's obvious that you're passionate and really work hard with those kids, and you have created a wonderful environment, but that often exists in school districts, particularly our intermediate school districts. And Madam Chair, we just had Superintendent Lewandowski in front of us the other day, they deal with children with some severe needs and multiple needs, and they are actually getting funding. I believe it was like $2,000 the average was, less than the state, yet they are increasing their graduation rates. And I have toured 287, which is has children from my district in it, and they have the soft lighting, and they've got paraprofessionals there, and are doing a great job to keep these kids calm so that they can learn. And one of my questions is to the parents: were you aware of, or had you explored intermediates?
Oh yeah,
Ms. Christensen Bruce, will you approach the microphone?
Sure.
The question.
I'm familiar with them, and I know they're being built. I think there's a new one being built in Woodbury right now, and maybe Blaine, but again, getting back to my particular child, that's more work for me. He is higher functioning, and these schools, as I understand them, are for the lower functioning autistic kids. And when you put my child with lower functioning autistic kids, he actually backslides. He will occasionally rise to the occasion of the quote unquote neurotypical or normal kids. And he doesn't need that either. He doesn't need that. And the school that he goes to, they have a lot of great things, but they also appear very much like a neurotypical school. So for me, that wasn't a good fit with him, and he would be with kids that are far more severe than him, and I was worried about him progressing academically at those schools. So I looked at one at what I forgot what the district is, but it was Valley Crossing in Woodbury. So,
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you for that. Well, there are in 287, and there are intermediates, and intermediates usually deal with the range from gifted, to varying degrees, to all the way to.
Yeah,
I just wanted to kind of point that out, but I don't want to get.
I also met with Stillwater School District, and they had a, they called it a cluster program in a school, and my worry there was they several times told me. We're going to start him off in this room, and then depending on how good he does, we'll put him in the regular room. I thought it should be reverse. I thought my child should be in the regular room, and then if needed support, should be pulled out.
Well, thank Representative Seltzer.
Thank you. Thank you. And I just wanted to point that out and kind of have that conversation. I do have the same concern that Representative Yaruso brought forward, and I am wondering, Representative Fenton, if you could tell me, on page 1, line 1.21 to 1.23, you're allowing any student, any eligible student with an IEP to be able to access these funds. And I'm wondering, you know, the stories that we've, you know, heard today, you know, are certainly affecting and, you know, certainly, you know, they seem to be much happier with their current placement. But if you're allowing any student, you've got a $10 or $20 million, whatever your cap is on the funding for this, how are we ensuring that it's the students that say that could benefit from this program? You know, other we've addressed the constitutionality, and I could jump into that, but I've had my able colleagues have done that, so I just have other questions around that. How are we ensuring that students that really need it are accessing it, or are we creating a system, Representative Fenton, with people who in the know, who have the time, you know, to look into these, you know, can decide maybe that they don't, you know, want their child to, you know, be in the public school. And since if you look on page six, lines 2.23 to 2.24, it says no eligible school or educational service provider shall be required to alter its creed, practices, and mission policies or curriculum in order to accept participating students. Maybe there's a good, you know, maybe there is a good, you know, private, and there's nothing wrong. I went to parochial school. There's nothing wrong with parochial schools, but a good parochial school that they'd rather have their child go to, so that has a good, you know, special education program. And, you know, what's to prevent that parent from deciding they want to move their child who is achieving in the public schools to a private school, and supplanting a parent because the funds will run out, that may benefit more from this service.
Representative Fenton, you want to take that one?
Well, first of all, this is open. This is a voluntary program. Okay, so it is any student that has an IEP. Okay, so essentially, I think any parent, as you go through the process of having an IEP, you're given specific information about the needs of your child, which allows you to make, so again, this is an innovative pilot project, 5 years. It gives you the opportunity to voluntarily decide if this is an avenue where you want to go to make the best choices from all of the options for your child. I mean, it's attributable to not just education, but to occupational therapy, physical therapies, tutoring. So you can custom design your child's education, your child with special needs. This is a voluntary program, and I hope that children of all segments, that their parents, because parents want the best for their child. Like I said, there's nobody that is going to be more accountable to that child's education than the parent. And so this is voluntary to anyone in need who has an IEP.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Representative Erickson, and thank you, Representative Fenton, but you still, and we won't go back and forth, but I still don't feel like my question was answered. And I just want to make that point. And I'd like to move on. I have another concern just with the details of your bill. If we look on page 2 and we look at 210 through 214 on there, so the parent, if I understand this, they're going to sign an agreement to arrange for the provision of organized appropriate educational services with measurable goals to the participating student in at least the subjects of reading, writing, mathematics, social studies, and science. You know, Representative Fenton, I think, do you think this might be putting a little bit too much of a burden on the parent? Because we spent hours debating just the number of tests and yesterday that, you know, measurable goals that students should be have to take, and, you know, what should those, and we were discussing, you know, what do those goals measure? We had questions, what do those tests measure? And you know what should students know? Those are other, you know, questions that we've grappled with as we have designed state standards. And so the parents are supposed to figure this out.
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chairman, Representative Seltzer, it seems that this is both sides of the same argument. There are no standards. There are too many standards. And there's no accountability. There's too much bureaucracy and rigor here. The purpose of this section, the purpose of giving parents the opportunity to go into public schools and giving those public schools the first chance to offer their services to those parents, is to develop the IEP, to develop the program customized to the child. And so this is just another component of making sure there is that plan that meets the accountability that is at the core of many of the questions being raised here. And so I think it's perfectly understandable that a parent, before bringing these marvelous resources, public resources, to alternative providers, knows what that parent is going to get for those dollars.
Representative Seltzer?
Last question. Thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. McGrath, for your answer, but that's not what the law said. And so I will, with what I'm reading in front of me. So I just have one more question. And again, thank you, Madam Chair. You have been very kind. Can you further explain, if we look on line 66 to 68,
judicial review.
Could you explain this a little bit more regarding the judicial process? What would this cost and who would have to pay for this?
Mr. McGrath, 6.6 through 6.8, the decision of the commissioner is subject to judicial review.
Oh, very good.
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, this is well-established administrative law that in every interaction that a citizen, a resident of the state of Minnesota has with the government, there is a process in which the agency makes the first determination, the first findings of facts, perhaps engages the services of an administrative law judge to document the facts and make a recommendation to the commissioner. But one of the features that exists in all administrative procedure acts is an appeal process. And so what this bill is doing is making clear the availability of, one, the Administrative Procedure Act, and two, the appeal process that exists. In terms of costs, it is the cost on the parent in terms of bringing their own claims, and if they choose to hire counsel, it is their cost. There is no attorney's fees provision in this bill, Representative, that would compensate the parents for legal costs, win or lose. And so the parent is absorbing all those costs. The agency is absorbing the costs related to the appeals.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes,
thank
and
you.
Members, remember, this will be discussed in government operations because this is part of the rulemaking, the establishment of the ESA that begins on page 4 and continues through page 6. So let's focus our questions on the policy, which would be on pages 1, 2, and continues onto page 3. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess first I just want to say that I believe in having a menu of choices, and I really expect the parents for being brave enough to come to the state to ask for help to allow your child the opportunity to be the best that they can be. I think, you know, that is really brave of you to do that. And I truly understand, you know, your feelings and feeling that so often that your child is not getting the services that they need in the public school system. And sometimes those feelings can be really real from coming from parents and looking at outcomes. And I know this is not the educational finance committee, you know, so questions around, you know, is this an open-ended pocketbook for, you know, parents to get the services that they need, you know, whether or not there would be a cap on the services to get the, to be able to support as many parents as possible. You know, how would this, you know, how would this fund be allocated so that it is meeting the needs of many, many parents to make the many, many choices that they want or need?
Representative Fenton.
Okay, so currently as the bill is written, this would be the per pupil funding plus the state contribution to special education would be put in the education savings account for the parent. This this bill also excludes the district cross subsidies, so that should actually help the school districts. But I, regarding to funding, I want to work with legislators to get the funding formula right before this gets to Ed Finance. So, but this currently is designed under the existing framework of Minnesota law.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
You know, our educational system is, you know, I could say we'd never have enough money to do all that we need to do with and for our children. What budget target would this fund come out of?
Representative Moran, Representative Fenton could possibly answer that, but that's a question for Ed Finance and for taxes or wherever else this bill might be headed. So I'm not sure that you could address that. Do you have another question, Representative Moran?
Yeah, one more question. And again, I talked about our public schools already facing significant obstacles to properly funding, you know, special education. So why would we redirect state dollars? Why would we redirect, you know, without the constitutional response, why would we redirect state dollars away from public schools to be used for kids who are in private school of their parents' choice?
Representative Fenton, explain your educational savings account again, please.
So essentially, this puts the parents in the driver's seat of their child with special needs, the education of that child. It offers the options and choices for parents who just want the best education possible. So essentially, again, it's allowing the parent who knows that child best to decide. And some parents, like myself included, will decide that the public school system is the best fit for their child. Other parents will decide that they need better options for their children. And so, again, the per pupil funding will follow them, but this is about educating children and what's best for children and not what's best for a bureaucratic system.
I have one last question, Madam Chair. So looking at the ESA establishment and looking at lines 5.28 to 5.35, you know, and I know parents want to do the best for their child, and hopefully they will, but in instances where they are not repaying back or submitting receipts and that type of places, you referenced that if a parent repays the amount within the requested time frame, then the offense would be recorded and held in the parent's file. But you're giving them three chances to correct this. Why three?
Okay, so Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Moran. I'll answer to some of this, and if I don't get it all, then Mr. McGrath can also chime in. But this is part of the anti-fraud provision. Okay, so essentially, you know, think of it as if you have a debit card, all right? A parent, this money is put into the savings.
I know. Wait, before we continue on, because I know we are short on time, why three chances?
Representative Fenton.
Okay.
Madam Chairman,
Mr. McGrath.
Representative Moran, this bill is designed to empower parents. It's an individualized program. But whenever you're dealing with money being directly sent to parents, there's a fraud component to that.
Absolutely.
Now, there are honest mistakes and there are not honest mistakes. The bill is intended to empower the commissioner to address misuse of these funds. Mm-hmm. And he can shut down based on a report, even before a hearing. He has the power to shut down the account, and then there are subsequent process after that. The idea of three strikes is that is a point in which the parent, it is clear, is no longer making honest mistakes. So there is much fraud in the public education system. This is an attempt to make sure that there are controls so as to realize the goal of the legislature, which is to educate children the best way possible.
Yeah, so the goal, Madam Chair, is to give them three chances to get it right.
To forgive honest mistakes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Wills, second to the last question. Representative Ward, you'll have the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I'm listening to the discussion, I had a few questions that kind of came up in my mind. And it's not directly to the bill, but just in thinking about how the state of Minnesota used to have a 529 plan for a college savings account. And how it worked was that the state matched dollars that parents or a grandparent would put in to save money for college expenses, which could be used at a public college or a private college. And there's legislation moving through the legislature now to reinstate that program. And it seems to have bipartisan support. So I'm wondering how this bill would compare to that, and because it seems like it's a very similar mechanism.
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chairman, Representative Wills, thank you for the question. This is the same model of 529 counts, of pre-K scholarships, of Pell Grants, of GI bills. It is the extension of what the state of Minnesota has been doing since Orville Freeman was governor. And it is the idea that you focus on children and their educational needs, and you provide the resources to them, and you establish accounts and funding mechanisms to allow that to happen.
And parents are in charge. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I understand your response, then essentially you're saying Minnesota's already done this and has supported this type of law in the past, and so it seems to fit with your argument that it's constitutional. And then it also brings up a question in my mind of if parents are taxpayers and they're paying into the state and then the state funds education, would a parent have to pay twice, essentially, if they're a taxpayer, but paying additionally for tuition if there wasn't a bill like this in law?
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chairman, Representative Wills, the answer to that is yes. Now, that's a long tradition in this country. We have a dual system. Mm-hmm. We respect the separation between the public and the private schools. We have a vibrant religious tradition in education dating back to the mid-19th century. And those schools are serving children today who are not members of their religion, but they're serving their missions. What this bill is all about is recognizing the extraordinary costs of educating children with special needs and helping those parents meet those costs in alternative ways.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. McGrath. So it seems to me that with a bill like this in law, it would allow the parents as taxpayers to use their tax dollars to fund the education that they feel is best for their families, right?
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chairman, Representative Wills, yes.
Representative Ward, last question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I've been trying not to talk because we've had a long morning already and we have more to do. But I do have some comments, and what this bill tells me is that, I mean, it just almost screams that we are not properly funding special education, which we all know. And there is a real need for it, and we need to do something about that. I don't believe this is the way to go. And in terms of this being, we've done vouchers for other things, not for K-12. That's public education. I could go on about that, but they're outside of K-12, yes, but not for K-12. I want to thank the parents for coming. You are the best advocates for your children. You have to be. We all, that's part of our role as parents, is to be the best advocates for our children, and you're doing remarkable work. It is a tough job. And sometimes doors are not open to you the way I wish they were. We need to fix that. And I wish that we were doing this in a different way so that we could accomplish what you're looking for, because it's very much needed. But I think many parents are not in a position, don't understand, don't have the skills, don't have the resources one way or another to be able to stretch themselves the way you have. And for a variety of life situations, they don't have the resources to do that. So, you know, with the variety of things that we have talked about, I'm thinking parents need a navigator. They need an advocate to help them find the resources, because there are little pockets in public education where we're doing really well. And what might work for one child is not necessarily going to work for another. So we need our choices. But we need to fund public education to do that, so that we are meeting those needs. I'm looking for current state ratings. Apparently there's not something that's readily available. But we keep trying to get better, and we need to do more. But nothing would, in this bill, prevent parents from inadvertently, mistakenly, or intentionally using those funds to put their children in with what could be interpreted as a cult, and we end up with somebody like the guy who got picked up in Brazil. There's no vetting for the programs and services that this bill is providing. So it could run the full spectrum, and that could be really good, but there's no vetting by the state for the money that the state is allowing. I could go on, but we've had a long morning.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call, please.
Thank you. A roll call has been requested, and a roll call there will be. Mr. McGrath, you had a comment to that? Representative Fenton, closing comments.
You know, no one size fits all, and as a parent of any parent can tell you that, especially if they're a parent of one or three or five kids. This bill is good for families and children with special needs. It offers options and choices, and parents want the best possible education for their kids. And there is nobody more accountable to the education of a child than the parent themselves. So I ask that this bill be sent on to government operations. House Thank File 1529. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. And members, remember, there is a great deal of rulemaking that has to occur in this proposed piece of legislation. So keep in mind if your, you know, your concerns are going to be addressed in the rulemaking process. So with that, members, the clerk will call the roll.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Vice Chair Bennett.
Yes.
Mariani. Absent. Bly. No. Christensen.
Yes.
Daphne.
No.
Kreisha.
Yes.
Lucero.
Yes.
Moran.
No.
Nornis.
Yes.
Peterson. Pearson. Seltzer.
No.
Erdahl. Ward.
No.
Whalen.
Yes.
Wills.
Yes.
Winkler. Yeah, Russo.
No.
Fenton. 8 ayes, 6 nays.
There being 8 yeses and 6 noes, the bill is sent to government operations. Thank you very much, parents who came to spend the morning with us, to other testifiers, to those who have concerns. Thank you. This has been a robust discussion, and we appreciate it very much. Former Representative Klinzing, will you please come to the testifying table for 1485? And members, I will move House File 1485 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome back, Ms. Klinzing, and I believe we have an amendment. I have an amendment to offer. And so, members, I'm going to move to members, I will move to delete the amendment that was adopted on Tuesday. And this amendment will replace that. Thank you. So, members, first of all, the removal of the, was it the A1? 2-1. Thank you, Ms. Larson. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. So that amendment is deleted, and I offer then the A3 amendment. Will you explain, Ms. Klinzing? And say your name for the record, please, before you we begin, so we know who you are, and proceed.
My name is Karen Klinzing. I'm here speaking on behalf of Friends of Education today, which authorizes charter schools here in Minnesota. They authorize 17 schools. The amendment before you gives the school board, charter school boards, the option of voting to give enrollment preference to low-income students using the free and reduced lunch status of families, free or reduced lunch status of families, as the proxy for determining that. There's an application for educational benefits that families fill out in schools, and that is what's referred to in this amendment as the application that they would fill out to verify that they do qualify for those benefits. Additionally, this option is only available for those charter school boards which have a charter school where the free or reduced lunch count for their school district is below either the geographic district within which they're located, or below the state average. In the case of Friends of Education, this would apply to 13 of their 17 schools at this point. Their remainder of their schools are well above the state or district average. What this new replacement amendment does also allows the school to be able to ask for whether families want to be considered for this preference on the application. Currently, statute is very prescriptive as to what may and may not be used or be asked for on the application. We did receive U.S. Department of Education non-regulatory guidance regarding this question, which I provided for you in print at the last hearing. That non-regulatory guidance does say that it is okay, it's acceptable to go ahead and ask for this information.
Ms. Klingzing, I'm going to interrupt you and withdraw the A3. We do not have the A4 in our folders, but that is the amendment that was posted. So, Ms. Larson, could you explain that, please? Or do you think that Ms. Klingzing has given a thorough explanation of it? Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, I would be glad to explain it, but I believe the Ms. Klingzing, who
she has been explaining it, yes.
Yes.
So with that, members, I'm going to move the A4 amendment, which has been posted, but for some reason, we'll get copies to you. So please continue with your discussion, and members know that I've moved the A4 amendment instead.
And just to point out with respect to the non-regulatory guidance from the U.S. Department of Education regarding charter schools using a low-income preference, I did find that there are at least three other states who do use the same measure as a proxy for low-income and do provide that enrollment preference. In addition, there's nine other states that actually allow for a preference for at-risk students, six with a preference for a specific program focus, which actually does sometimes include the low-income students in serving those students. So I thought that was interesting information. What I did not find is any legal challenges yet nationally. That doesn't mean they don't exist. I just haven't found them yet. They could exist. I did find a few that exist around sibling preference or board or employee preference. And right now, of course, Minnesota already has those preferences in statute, mm-hmm. as do about 18 other states. So as a result, it did not include the specific information or part to this amendment that would require immunity from liability. Additionally, we already, and last time, if you remember, the bill right before us gave preference to low-income students, children who were seeking pre-K scholarships to attend schools of their choice. It's a tradition, both at the collegiate level as well as at the pre-K level, for us to consider income in our preference for giving those families some choices. So this gives it this decision to the boards of the charter schools, so it's not a blanket mandate. It actually puts some more autonomy and discretion in the hands of our charter school boards, as was intended when that law was passed over 20 years ago.
Members, discussion? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I never know what to call you. Ms. Klingzing, Representative, just to add to the confusion. Good to see you. When you were here the other evening, you passed out this, and we all agreed that it was hard to read, but I squinted a lot and was able to read it. I don't understand the point, and I don't think you had an opportunity the other evening to explain the rationale for distributing this.
Ms. Klingzing.
Thank you, Representative Dabney and members of the committee. The reason I handed that particular graph out, and again, I apologize that it is still hard to read, is that the authorizer that is promoting this bill sees that their schools are doing well with the students who do currently qualify for free or reduced lunch status, that in most of those schools the students are performing not only above the state average of free and reduced lunch students, but they're also performing above the state average in general, proficiency-wise, on the math and reading tests. So what the authorizer wants to do is put a give the school boards, the charter school boards, the opportunity to, if this is a goal of theirs to serve these students more, to give them the right to do that and provide that preference.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But Ms. Klinzing, the majority of these schools, that all of these are Friends of Education schools, if I understand them, obviously Clark Field is a public school district, Minneapolis is a public school district, but the others are charters. With a couple of exceptions, generally serve very few free and reduced price children. So I'm trying to understand the comparison you're making when Aspen only serves 13%, Beacon Prep only 17% free and reduced lunch, St. Croix Prep 8%. I'm not understanding that, I'm not seeing any validity to the statistics you're using, and I'm confused.
Ms. Klinzing.
Thank you, Representative Dabney, members of the committee. There are other schools on that list that equally serve, like Hennepin Elementary serves 95.7%, mm-hmm. Northeast College Prep 92.4%, Westside Summit 93% of their students are free reduced lunch. Millennium, New Millennium, 85%, Minneapolis Academy, 86%. Clarkfield Area Charter is actually a charter school serving 56.7% free or reduced lunch status. So there are a significant number of schools on that list that do serve more than the district or state average. And the authorizer would like to give that opportunity to these other schools to be able to increase their numbers as well and serve more of those students. But the students they do have right now are doing quite well, even in the schools that you cited.
Representative Dabney.
Well, Madam Chair, when you've only got 8% kids free and reduced and no homeless kids like St. Croix Prep, I don't know that that's the heavy lifting that's challenging our schools. The 15 schools that you identify have a grand total of 9 homeless children across 15 schools and thousands of students. I don't see that, by and large, with a couple of exceptions, that the schools you're highlighting here as doing so well with the neediest students are actually generally serving the neediest students. And I also don't understand, you establish one reading level and one math level as your comparison, but we actually test, as you know, a multitude of grade levels. And we don't establish a single reading level or a single math level. We do it by grade level. So which grade level did these come from?
Representative Ms. Klinzing.
The data you're looking at is an average of the grade level's proficiency.
Madam Chair, a weighted average, unweighted average, how were these statistics arrived at?
They're not weighted in this case, but to the point of not serving enough students to get a representative sample, I just disagree because there are a number of the schools on that list that do have more than a representative mm-hmm. sample. And other schools that you listed that are serving Da Vinci 17.3%, Eagle Ridge 17.9%, Paideia 16.4%, they're still getting up close within 3 or 4 percentage points. The goal is to seek this opportunity not just for Friends schools but for all charter school boards in the state to go ahead and self-determine whether they want to serve more of these students.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Quinn.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. No further discussion. All those we can't vote on the amendment yet because we don't have it in front of us. It's being printed. Sorry about that. Representative or Ms. Klinzing, do you want to then just go over the entire bill as it would look if we had adopted the amendment? Just give us an overview so that we have a clear understanding mm-hmm. when it arrives.
So with this bill, the school board would have the option of voting to decide whether to add low income as an enrollment preference to their list of enrollment preferences. They would use free or reduced lunch price status as the proxy for that determination. In order to do that, then, they would have to be given legal access, or I should say authority, to go ahead and ask if families want to be considered for that enrollment preference. So that would be then allowed on the application. If they do check that box on the application, they would then receive the educational benefits application and be able to have that, or be able to fill that out, so the charter school could then definitively verify that they would qualify for that low income preference. Then they would then get a priority status on the waiting list. It would be, of course, as school boards or the charter school boards already do, they have to establish some sort of priority for the preferences, because there's already a preference for siblings, preference for employees. They would have to determine where this particular preference would be established in that priority set. And then the charter schools would be able to go ahead and run their lottery and assign the lottery numbers according to the preference priorities that they established. They could go ahead and continue this. First of all, they could only do this if their current free reduced rate lunch price number or count is below the state or local average. Once they've done it, they can continue to do it until the board votes to discontinue.
Thank you, Ms. Klinzing. And members, now we have the language in front of us, so please take a moment to review that based on the explanation we've heard before we take our vote. Is there any further discussion? Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, to briefly explain the difference between the A3 that was before you and the A4, the significant change is on the A4 document is the sentence that appears on 1.8 and 1.9, and it's something Ms. Klinzing clarified, and that is that a charter school initially must ask on the enrollment application whether the student is eligible for and interested in the enrollment preference. And having asked that, then the charter school is allowed to send the application for educational benefit form and ask if the household of a student who would be both interested and eligible, whether they want to be considered for the enrollment preference. That's the clarification in the A4 that was not quite stated in the A3.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please say yes. 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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Representative Klinzing, you can't go any place yet. Closing comments, please. And I know I should be making the closing comments, but I'm going to ask you to make them, since I'm the author of the bill.
We've worked on this bill to make sure it tries to actually align with other policy positions, both nationally and at the state level. And I did pass out the National Alliance for Public School Charters position, public charter schools, excuse me, which also supports this enrollment preference and this really the board's self-determination of it, the charter school boards. Additionally, most of the position statement from the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools is also represented in this bill. That's why the language has changed from this from last year to this year. The piece that's missing is that liability piece, and we've tried to do our due diligence in checking on the threat or concern about that. But in general, we hope that those schools that want to serve students who come from less means and to give them a choice and opportunity and access to education the same rates as all the other students, that they will get that through this opportunity and through the charter school's board self-determination.
And Ms. Klinzing, we do have some testifiers, I think, with concerns or with other comments, so please come forward. Anyone who has wants to make a comment or express a concern about this, welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record. Sorry that we're so confused this morning.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dan DeBruin, and I am the Associate Director at the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. I'm actually here today speaking on behalf of Gene Piccolo, who is unfortunately unable to be here.
Thank you for filling in for us.
Absolutely. So I will do my best. I'm also a rookie testifier, so I'll do my best to share the perspective of the association. Max is not supportive of the bill in its current fashion, and I want to share with you some of the rationale behind that, much like Representative Yaruso shared on the previous testimony. We believe that charter schools need to be open to all regardless of race, gender, and we would include income as a part of that. We recognize that there are current preferences given in the law. We do not believe that those preferences should be expanded beyond where they currently are. I will also share with you that I spent 13 years as a director of a charter school, Pact Charter School in Ramsey. That school had about 2,000 kids on its waiting list, still does, and we had many issues with the current preferences as they're laid out and difficulty with which ones you give priority to. And so that's just one example of why we think we need to sort out our current preferences before we start adding more preferences. And we also want to make sure that that charter schools are not somehow viewed as being elite and adding additional preferences to their list. So secondly, I would say that one of the reasons we have an issue with the liability is because currently the Department of Education fairly clearly states that there are only certain things you can include on your enrollment application, and I'm not sure that they have weighed in on whether low-income preference would be one of those things that would be allowable on an enrollment application. Now, when they go in and do audits, particularly special ed audits, one of the things they ding most charter schools on is their enrollment application and what they're asking people for. And the whole purpose behind that, of course, is to ensure that schools aren't discriminating based on disability. Thirdly, I would say I just want to share some stats with you regarding charter schools so that we don't have this vision that somehow this is a major issue with charters across the state. Currently, and this is based on October 1 counts that are on the Department of Ed website, currently charter schools serve around 55% of students who receive free and reduced price meals. The state average is around 38%. So charters are already serving quite a bit more as a whole on average. Of the 158 charter schools, 71% of them already serve above the state average of students receiving free and reduced lunch. That leaves approximately 47 schools, or 29.75%, that are below the state average. And if you were to go and look at every one of those schools, you would find, much like Representative Dabney was indicating previously, that many of them are already in districts that serve a population of free and reduced that's very similar to their school, or they have very specialized programs such as immersion, Montessori, classical education that don't tend to be chosen by, or I should say that in reverse, they're chosen very specifically for their program, not because they're free and reduced price students. So we believe that this particular provision would have very minimal impact, and it's that we don't believe it's necessary. So that's hopefully helps to explain the association's perspective on this particular proposal.
Thank you, Mr. DeBrun.
Yep.
Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Brian Sweeney, and I'm with Charter School Partners, a charter support group here in the state. We are generally supportive of Max's position and 92.8% of the issues out there, and there are two issues this morning where we're going to respectfully disagree. In addition to, we have 30 partner schools from the Twin Cities. Many of them are suburban schools and inner city schools, and we are supportive of the inclusion of FRL exclusion to the state charter law. We were concerned about the legal questions that were asked, and very legitimate questions, but we are satisfied that those legal questions have been answered. So we support this piece of legislation.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to share a comment? I think we're ready to vote. So, members, I will renew my motion that...
Madam Chair.
Ms. Whalen. Sorry about that. Yes, please. Question of one of the testifiers or Ms. Clinsing?
Ms. Clinsing,
I believe. Ms. Clinsing, of course. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, and actually to the testifiers as well, thank you so much for your comments. My ears kind of perked up when you referenced PACT, as that's in my district, PACT Charter School. I have great admiration and respect for PACT, and I think they do a fantastic job. And I really want to do everything I can to support them. So when you mentioned concern with the bill, I just I want to make sure that we are working to address that. And I read the amendment again to make sure, but it does say it. And this is my question for you, Ms. Kinsley. It doesn't look like it would be required to use that preference. It's right. Just that they may use that preference. So I think for PACT, if you have a lot of preference or various things on the enrollment application, they would not have to add this. I just want to make sure that I'm clear on that.
Ms. Clinsing, restate that.
You are Representative
Whalen.
Committee, that is accurate. What our intent with this and what we believe the language does is gives that decision to the charter school board to decide.
Okay, thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. With that, I renew the chair's motion that 1485, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, Ms. Clinsing. And our last bill on the agenda today is House File 1657. The chair will move her bill to be before the committee with possible inclusion, laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Welcome to our committee. These are the testifiers. Members, this is basically a bill for authorizers to close a charter school if in the previous three consecutive years the performance of the charter based on federal school accountability measures and our state accountability measures has not proceeded to grow and places the school in the bottom 10% of all public schools as determined by our education commissioner. I think this is something we really need to pay attention to, and so I welcome to the table the testifiers to support my 1657. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Brian Sweeney with Charter School Partners. The chair just outlined the legislation. It would also allow the authorizer to choose not to close a charter school, and it would submit a written justification for that by December 1st of a particular year. There was a concern. Representative Moran is not here, but she was very concerned that this bill might adversely impact such very fine credit recovery programs like High School for the Recording Arts, Fraser Institute, Metro Deaf School, which you had a tremendous, impressive testimony yesterday, Lionsgate, etc. And again, this bill recognizes that closure should be the last resort, not only after consistent effort to improve a school is not successful, and we believe it does give additional legal support to authorizers who are often hesitant to close a school because of the threat of a lawsuit and difficulty in doing so. So, Mr. Fan, would you like
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney, for explaining the default, because that is a very important piece. We're just not going to indiscriminately force charter schools to close, but there is an accountability standard that I think is very good, which is why I love carrying this bill. Mr. Pham, please introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Al Fan. I am the Executive Director for Charter School Partners. I just wanted to highlight that this legislation is designed to be both an authorizer empowerment bill and also a charter accountability bill. The legislation is seeking to address the many challenges that authorizers face in closing down persistently low-performing charter schools and empowers them to do so. We want to acknowledge the difficulty that authorizers face in closing a school down and the many pressures they receive from parents, teachers, and the community, including the threat of lawsuits. So we applaud those authorizers who have already made this difficult decision in the past, and we want to encourage more authorizers to hold their own schools to the same high rigorous standards. We also want to acknowledge that there are more variables, considerations, and measures besides test scores, but we believe that using a minimum 10% threshold for academic is a low, very low bar for schools, and we believe that this legislation is designed to give additional cover and support to authorizers, specifically legal support to authorizers who may be hesitant to close down their schools even if they're not meeting the minimum performance standards set forth in their contract. I also wanted to emphasize that this is also this legislation is also a charter accountability bill. When the charter law was first created in 1991, charter schools were given a very high degree of autonomy and flexibility to innovate and to create new models for educating children. In exchange, charters were also expected to be held to a very high standard of accountability. So we have seen many, many examples throughout the state now that this bargain has worked. We're seeing schools that are both innovative and deliver exceptional outcomes. Schools like Eagle Ridge Academy and Eden Prairie, Trek North High and Bemidji, which uses an Outward Bound curriculum, Aspen Academy and Savage. There are multiple performing arts schools. There are many language immersion schools like Yinghua in Northeast Minneapolis, German Immersion in St. Paul. There are Montessori schools, classical schools, STEM schools. So there just are really a growing number of high-performing schools throughout the state. And even in the urban cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, every year the Star Tribune publishes a Beating the Odds analysis, which highlights that the schools that are outperforming or having the highest performance of academic outcomes for the children, even if they have a high percentage of low-income students, are typically charter schools in both Minneapolis and St. Paul's. And these are schools you have heard about, like Harvest Prep, Hiawatha Academies, Higher Ground, Global Academy, and Community of Peace. So these schools, we believe, are proof that all schools can and should be able to deliver a very high impact level of education for all of their students, regardless of race, income, or zip code. And so 5 years ago, when we were talking about charter school closures, it was very difficult to justify because there were really so few, if any, options for the children if the school closed. But today, because there are so many more options available, both in the inner city and outstate, we believe that it's time to really have this accountability measure put into the statute. Last year, both the Minnesota Public Radio and the Star Tribune editorial board highlighted the high number of charter schools that are chronically underperforming and the need for greater accountability in this sector. And this legislation, as Mr. Sweeney said, and was designed by the chair, would flag those charters that have underperformed and have that have performed in the bottom 10% of the state for 3 years in a row. And again, we believe that this is a very low bar, but we would require the authorizer to close these schools or provide some written justification to the commissioner for keeping them open. And I think the point I want to make here is that this really is only one strategy for improving the overall charter school sector. We continue to support the startup of new high-performing schools, the expansion of existing high-performing schools, and the replication of ones that are really doing well. So there are multiple strategies that are required to improve the quality of the overall sector. having this bill to empower the authorizers and to hold the charters accountable is another strategy in improving the overall sector. So in conclusion, we just urge your support for House File 1657 as a means to empower authorizers to close down the state's lowest performing charter schools and to increase the level of accountability on charter schools so that we can work towards increasing the number of high-quality seats for all children in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fan. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Josh Crossan, and I'm with Minnesota's Campaign for Achievement Now. Madam Chair and members, MNCAN fully supports HF 1657 for two reasons. One, and first and foremost, it's for the kids. By empowering authorizers, we are allowing them to make the best decisions possible for the kids in the room rather than the concerns of the adults in the room. And secondly, this is for parents. We must respect the needs of all parents. I've never met a parent, as it's been said before in this committee, I've never met a parent who doesn't want the best for their kid. But unfortunately, as it's also been said in this committee recently, unfortunately, not all parents have the time, the resources, the know-how, or even the language abilities to navigate the public education system. So we must be advocates, especially for these parents. This bill, through its reporting requirements, gives parents more tools to help navigate the system, and it also allows authorizers to close low-performing schools and requires them to redirect its students to much more nurturing and successful school systems. So with that, MNCAN fully supports this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Crossan. Mr. Sweeney.
Madam Chair, committee members, I just wanted to point out in your packet there are two letters, one from the National Association of Charter School Authorizers, which is the national association that is trying to improve the authorizer sector in the country in support of our this bill, of the chair's bill, as well as a letter from Friends of Education who are supportive, which Friends of Education, it wasn't pointed out that Friends actually serves the most students of all authorizers in the state. It doesn't have as quite as many schools, but it does serve the most children in the state. In addition, Charter School Partners represents 30 partner schools in the Twin Cities, and these are amongst the state's highest performing public schools. And for them, this is an important piece of legislation because they feel that the biggest challenge to the charter community are not opponents of charter schools necessarily, but the lowest performing and problematic charters that periodically get in the newspaper. There's, you know, a situation that puts charters in bad light. So, and also wanted to say that the Business Partnership and the Chamber are supportive of us as well. And I don't know if the
Department.
MDE is
they are.
Would like to make any comments on it, but I think we've been in touch with them regarding this and how it fits into the authorizer accountability system that presently is in place, including the review of authorizers.
So yes, Mr. McHenry is here. Please join us. Thank you, gentlemen. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. We just wanted to weigh in in support of this bill, and thank you for bringing it forward. The work that the Charter Division at the Minnesota Department of Education has been undertaking the last couple of years has been building our authorizer evaluation system. What that system does, it holds authorizers accountable, or MDE in the state, we hold authorizers accountable. We oversee, we hold them accountable for how they manage their portfolio of schools, how they manage the finances, how they manage just the management, as well as the academic performance. This would be another tool for authorizers to use as part of how they are holding their schools accountable. Because the role of the authorizers in Minnesota is to hold the schools accountable, and the role of MDE is to make sure that we're holding those authorizers accountable. So we see this as a good tool that could fit in with our evaluation system, and wanted to weigh in with our support on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry. Are there others who would like to testify? Please come forward. Welcome to our committee again, and say your name again and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dan DeBruin, Associate Director at the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. And I do have to say I feel a little bit like the underdog here, given the list of names that have been
presented in favor of this. I will say that MAX does represent the majority of charter schools across the state. Our membership is over 50% of the charter schools in the state. So MAX, as you probably gathered, is not in favor of this bill in the way that it's presented. And if you allow me just to share a few reasons for that. One, we believe that the law as it's currently written already allows for authorizers to shut down schools. I should tell you as a little background. I also worked at the Department of Education for a year and a half as the authorizer specialist. Mm-hmm. I read all of these contracts that came from authorizers and schools and reviewed all of the goals that are required to be a part of those contracts, which includes academic goals. And authorizers already hold schools accountable for those things, and they have the authority within the law to shut those schools down if necessary. And in fact, many of them have shut schools down over the years. So we don't feel that this addition to the law is necessary. I would say, as has already been mentioned, the department is in the process of reviewing authorizers. They just started that process this winter. They have not completed that process. In fact, I was a part of that process in the beginning and putting that together, that review process. They've just begun that process. It'll take another year and a half or so to complete. So I would say we don't even know at this point if it's necessary to include this in the law. And whether authorizers are completing their job and shutting down schools in the way that has been presented here. So I would say let's let the process play out and see if indeed the review process accomplishes what it's set out to do. I would also mention that this bill is intended to offer some protection for authorizers. I would say those protections are already in place. The authorizers have an approved authorizer application with the department. It already lays out all of their processes and what they're going to be doing, approved by the department. As long as they're following those processes and giving notice to schools the way that is already in their process, this should not be an issue. And lastly, I'll just kind of reiterate that MAX is also in favor of accountability for schools and also for authorizers. We do believe that there should be autonomy as a part of that as well. They need to follow their contract, and they already have the authority to shut down schools. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Representative Bly, you have a question. Is it for someone at the table, or do you need someone to join us?
I'll ask the question, and
thank
we'll
you.
See if anyone
Go
can
ahead,
give us an
please.
Answer. Thank you, Chair. One of the things I think that concerns me that I haven't heard mentioned was that, you know, I remember when the charter school law came into effect, and one of the things that was talked about was parents, along with educators who have innovative or interesting ideas or things they want to try, have, you know, some influence or some connection with that. And it concerns me, I guess, that this effort to close schools and to determine whether or not schools are high-functioning or good schools or not good schools kind of ignores the parent view of this. I mean, I think you made some mention of it, but, in some ways, if a school is not performing well and parents are sending their kids to the school, you'd think that they would, especially since there are many options, as you say, that they might choose to have their child go somewhere else. There are lots of reasons that a school may be judged high-performing or good or, you know, other than the test scores. And also, depending upon what the goals of that school might be, independent of those things. And, you know, one of the things I think that's happened over the years as we have moved down this accountability path is that we ignore some of those important other aspects of good schools, including charter schools. And the other thing I would say is that my concern is, knowing that a number of the advocates for this are funded by corporate interests, it worries me that we are encouraging the needs and interests of corporate America against parents. If you could alleviate my concerns or talk to me about that.
Mr. Sweeney.
Madam Chair, Representative Bly, thank you for the question. We have always said that we are absolutely agnostic as to the type of pedagogy or curriculum that's involved in a school. Amongst our 30 schools that we work with and represent, we have core knowledge, project-based, dual language, American Indian, very innovative. I mean, you're talking about the tension between innovation and accountability, and I think it's a very legitimate tension. We are agnostic as to the type of school it is. We're not agnostic as to whether or not it is serving the child and the family, both academically, you know, as well as in a well-rounded way.
Yes. Go ahead, sir.
Madam Chair and Representatives, Representative Bly, just in response to, you had really two questions. One about the corporate interest. I can't address that particular one. MAX is a membership-only organization. We do not take corporate funds, which I think is significant in representing the schools across the state. Your second, I just wanted to mention to you, I didn't mention in my original list, but that is that we also have an alternative measures bill that we believe would address some of the things that you are mentioning, and that is that there are other ways of looking at the success of a school in addition to the academic measures that we hope will move forward as well. And I think without that, that's one of the reasons that we struggle with this particular bill.
Chair, Mr. Sweeney.
Chair Erickson and Representative Blythe, we are supportive of this. This bill as well. We again recognize, as we mentioned before, that there are incredible charter schools that are representing, you know, a at-risk, special need, credit recovery. And again, we all point to High School for the Recording Arts, which does the work of the Lord. They're out there on the street literally taking a 17-year-old kid and bringing him in the building and trying to get them a high school degree within a couple of years. So.
Yeah, and Mr. Sweeney, thank you for bringing up that charter school, because they are amazing young people, and they've come so far, and they do so well, and we're so proud of them. So thank you for bringing that up. Is there any further discussion? Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember we had a similar bill a couple of years ago, and this one is a little bit more moderate in its approach, so I appreciate that. It just struck me during the testimony here, comparing the previous bill and this one, you know, we get told that every parent is capable of deciding what's best for their kid, and then we get told that not all parents are capable of tracking. And the reality is in between, you know, that almost every parent has the best interest of their child. There are a few that, you know, end up jailed for not. Some parents are capable of navigating the many, many choices that are in front of them. I don't know if it lies, you know, where, if that approach is most or not. It is quite complex. So we need to avoid these sweeping statements that, you know, every parent does this or every parent does that. That's not going to be true. And we have to strike a balance in all of these between parent choice and the state accountability. Mm-hmm. So I do appreciate this. This is a more moderate approach, and I really appreciate that we have the kind of escape clause that the school is able to give an explanation, because we do have some really good models of schools that are taking care of some very, very needy kids, and so I appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Yarusso, and often it is the school itself who engages parents, and so they know what is offered and what their alternatives are. So I think that's incumbent upon all schools to engage with parents so they know what's available. We heard that in our first bill today from parents, that they need to know, and we hope that they're learning through our schools and otherwise. Any comment to Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Technical question to the testifiers. There's currently a charter school in St. Paul that I forget the name of. Very troubled. The department has looked into it. The authorizer has recommended the termination of the director. The board has refused. There's accusations of legal violations. There's accusations of financial improprieties. Very serious. And the board has refused to act, is what I've picked up in the media and from talking with some people affiliated with the school.
Mr. McHenry, are you coming?
They may even have changed authorizers. I'm uncertain about that. But what I'm looking at is the language on 2.35 through 3.14. Mm-hmm. If I don't know who authorizes the school and then finds it to be underperforming and moves to change it, what prevents them from simply changing authorizers?
Mr. McHenry. Please say your name for the record again and begin.
Madam Chair, Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. And to Representative Dabney's question, did you want me to go to the specifics of the school you were asking in that situation, or the general question as far as what would
happen? I think the general question.
Precisely. I was just laying the base for my concerns.
So a general question.
Yes. Sure. Appreciate that. Madam Chair, Representative Dabney. Right now, in order for a school, or if an authorizer is going to close, or an authorizer is going to close or close a school, not close a school. If the authorizer closes a school, they need to notify the school that they are planning on closing. Mm-hmm. The school then needs to actually apply through the department to be first they need to be accepted by another authorizer, and they need to send an application to the department to actually be applied to merge or switch authorizers. In order for that to happen, what the department looks at is that, number one, the performance of the school and how that school is managed from its current authorizer, and the goals of the new authorizer, how the performance goals for that school fit into the authorizer's goal process. Is it something that's aligned? Is it something that's not aligned? So they would have to apply through the department, actually, to be approved to merge to a different authorizer.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Mr. McHenry, I don't see the alignment that you're talking about between the procedures and processes of the proposed new authorizer and the existing underperforming charter school as being an impediment to that school simply saying, and the authorizer saying, this is a better fit than the current one, and they're simply continuing to operate but with the new authorizer. I'm sure you hate speculating on tape, but do you want to speculate on the chances that if the department refused the new authorizer taking over the school, what's the chance you would experience being sued?
Mr. McHenry, I'm not sure you want to answer that directly, but please proceed if you feel comfortable.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, you raise a good question, and obviously that's something that, you know, we have to consider in how we are overseeing authorizers. We have to consider everything we're doing, not just from the educational perspective, but from the legal perspective as well. One of the things that we are seeing with that is a policy discussion or something for you all to consider that we're struggling with as well, is what happens when an authorizer closes terminates their, or no longer is authorizing their schools. What happens with that group of schools that they are currently authorizing? There could be homeless charter schools, for lack of a better term, that may be performing well. And there may be some that may not be performing academically well. But as we're moving forward in our authorizer evaluation process, and with this current authorizer that is no longer planning on authorizing, we are interested in seeing how some of these other schools will fall, how they will match with other authorizers, and we are actually waiting to see how a new transfer of authorizer applications from all of these schools, and we haven't seen all of those just yet.
Just one last technical question for Mr. McHenry.
Is academic performance a criteria that the department is authorized to use in evaluating the transfer of an authorizer?
Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, again, when we look at the performance of the school and the school's plan for academic, their curriculum, and how that aligns to the authorizer's plan for oversight, what we're really looking at is how those merge and are those consistent together. That's what we're really looking for. In our evaluation system, which is separate from transferring authorizers, we do look at academic performance, but we look at academic performance under the entire portfolio of schools that the authorizer is authorizing.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Dent,
it does seem, if I'm understanding Mr. McHenry right, that this bill does not authorize, I've got to change my language, does not allow the department, in considering the transfer of an authorizer for a charter school, to consider the academic performance of the school, only the alignment of that school's mission, curriculum, that sort of thing, with the proposed authorizer. And so it would set up a situation where an authorizer would move to close a school under the authority of this bill, the school would find a new authorizer, and the department would have no statutory grounds on which to deny it if the new authorizer stated that their approach aligned with the charter school.
Mr. DeBrun.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Dabney. Just I wanted to mention to you that I actually used to review these change of authorizer applications, and statutorily they're actually required. The previous authorizer has to state all of the issues and the reasons why, which would include academics in most cases, and that school and new authorizer must address those issues and how they're going to deal with them as a part of the becoming the new authorizer. So I can't think of a case where academics was not addressed. In fact, that's almost always the case. They have to indicate, here's where the academic issues were, here's how they're going to be addressed, and here's a plan moving forward.
Mr. McHenry.
And Madam Chair, to follow up on that, that's correct, but it does have to fit in. That plan has to fit into the plan of the authorizer that the school would transfer to.
Right.
Madam Chair, it just seems that regardless the, I think, good intention of this, unless we explicitly empower the department to consider academic performance, we're at a minimum missing the practical impact of this bill and likely setting up the department for lawsuits when a underperforming school is closed by the authorizer, finds a new authorizer, and the department does not have the authority to deny the transfer of authorizer.
Mr. McHenry, can you comment to that point, if possible?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, we're more than happy to continue looking at the language to clarify that, understand where you're coming from, and we definitely want to make sure we can avoid any potential lawsuits with this.
Thank you.
Yes, and thank you, Representative Dabney, for raising that. I will certainly look into that as the author of this bill. Thank you, Mr. McHenry. So, members, closing comments from your chair as the author. House File 1657, I think, is an invaluable tool that we have in our school choice to empower authorizers to this extent. There may be some work that we need to do to ensure what Representative Dabney has raised. But aside from that, I think this is a good measure for us to consider. And with that, the chair renews her motion that 1657 be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much for spending the morning with us. We will resume meeting on Tuesday at 8:15. To experience the walkthrough of the 2015 Education Innovation Omnibus Bill. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.